One of the principles that we set forth the first night, or at least the next day, was 1 Corinthians 10:11, that all these things happened as examples of the end of the world. We looked at 1 Corinthians 14:32, which said the spirit of the prophets are subject unto the prophets, which means the prophets are all in agreement with each other. We read a quote from Sister White where she says, each of the ancient prophets spoke more for our day than the days in which they lived, so that their prophesying is in force for those of us who live at the end of the world. In other words, the testimony of the Bible is illustrating the end of the world. And we touched on, I've even mentioned it here once tonight, but in Proverbs 28:19, I think, it says that where there is no vision, the people perish. 18. And I'm suggesting that there is a vision at the end of the world, a prophetic understanding that is life or death. If you don't have it, you perish. It's parallel to the increase of knowledge in Daniel 12, where Sister White says, or Daniel says, the wise understand this increase of knowledge that comes from a book that's sealed, but the wicked don't understand. And then in Hosea 6:4, it says, my people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. Daniel 12, Hosea 4, is speaking about the end of the world. If you reject this understanding, you're destroyed. If you accept this understanding, you're wise. You're the wise virgins as opposed to the foolish virgins. This understanding is another way to express not having a vision. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Look at Isaiah 29. That's what it's speaking about. It says, the vision of them has become as a book that is sealed, that is given to one that is learned. And said, and asked to read it, and he says, I cannot read it, for it is sealed. His vision is sealed, and it's life or death. And then in Daniel 11, verse 14, we dealt with, it says, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also thy robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. The theologians in Adventism today, at least some of them, I don't know all the theologians, I know very few actually, but some of them teach that the robbers of thy people here in verse 14 of Daniel 11 is one of the last Syrian kings, whereas the pioneer position is that the robbers of thy people was pagan Rome. They would exalt themselves, but they would fall. And they were the prophetic key that would establish the vision. It's Rome that establishes the vision. And you can go into the writings of William Miller, which there are not that many, and you find that in his time period, one of the things that he argued with the Protestants of his day and age about is verse 14 of Daniel 11. The Protestants were teaching that the robbers of thy people in verse 14 was one of the last Syrian kings. And William Miller said, no, this is Rome. So pioneers not only understood that the robbers of thy people was Rome, and that's what established the vision, but they had a controversy about it. And we have that controversy in Adventism today, only it's amongst ourselves. And my point is this. The vision that we don't have, if we don't have this vision, we perish. That vision is established by Rome. Rome is what establishes the vision. And therefore, when it comes to the book of Daniel, over and over again, portrays Rome in two phases. I've been, not promoting, but I've been endorsing at least the book Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith, even though, as I've said, there's some things in there that I disagree with. Nevertheless, it's God's helping hand. If you have a Seventh-day Adventist that wants to very quickly come to understand the historical foundations for Daniel and Revelation as the pioneers understood them, the best book to give them is Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith or Daniel the Prophet and the Seer of Patmos by Haskell. I'm not threatened by that. They complement one another. But Sister White says, Daniel and Revelation is God's helping hand. And one of the things that I disagree with in there, we mentioned this before, this is a recap, is that the pioneers are bringing all the prophecies to an end by 1843. They thought everything was coming to the end. So when it came to Daniel 2, they believed that these 10 toes were pagan Rome. The feet of iron and clay were pagan Rome. Sister White doesn't agree with that. Sister White says, we have now come to the time where the iron is mixed with miry clay. And even in Daniel 2, if you look closely, the 10 toes are 10 kings that are in existence in the days when God sets up his kingdom. And God did not set up his kingdom in the time period of the 10 nations of pagan Rome. What's my point? Here's my point. Daniel chapter 2, if you don't hold on to the pioneer position that they were forced to accept because they thought the world was coming to an end in 1843, you realize that in Daniel chapter 2, that Rome is portrayed in two phases with the two legs. If you can say that the two shoulders are the Medes and the Persians, then you can say the two legs are the two phases of Rome. And with Sister White's endorsement of the toes and the iron and clay taking place at the end of the world, you're on safe ground. And the 10 toes on Daniel 2 connect with the 10 kings of Revelation 17. They're the civil power at the end of the world. In fact, if you realize in the story of Elijah, and I hope you do, that Elijah had to deal with a threefold enemy, Jezebel, an impure church, Ahab, a civil power, the priest of Baal, a deceiving power. Who's that represent? The beast, the dragon, and false prophet. But it's teaching us that at the end of the world, there will be an impure church, a deceiving power, and a civil power. And Ahab is the symbol of the civil power. And who was Ahab king of? The 10 tribes, the 10 toes, the 10 kings of Revelation 17. There's at least five places in Scripture where the civil power at the end of the world has associated with it the number 10. You can look at Psalm 83. You can look at Ezekiel 37. So 10 is a number of the civil power. But in any case, in the book of Daniel, Rome is portrayed in two phases, pagan and papal. When you get to Daniel 7, Rome is portrayed. When pagan Rome comes into Daniel 7, it's called the diverse kingdom. It's diverse than the kingdoms before it. That's pagan Rome. But when the papacy comes into Daniel 7, it says that he's diverse from the first king. Pagan Rome and papal Rome in Daniel 7 are the diverse kingdom. Daniel always portrays Rome in two phases. In Daniel chapter 8, the pioneers correctly understand that Rome comes into Daniel chapter 8 in verse 9. The little horn, the pioneers correctly teach that the little horn of verse 9 of Daniel 8 is Rome in both its phases, pagan and papal. Daniel 11, pagan Rome, when it conquers Syria, becomes the king of the north. Daniel 11 establishes what defines the king of the north. The power that controls Babylon is the king of the north. Syria, in that time period of pagan Rome, included Babylon. And when Rome conquered Syria, it became the king of the north until it was conquered by the papacy. The papacy conquered it in Daniel 11. So in Daniel 11, pagan Rome and papal Rome, two phases under the term the king of the north. Point is, in the book of Daniel, Rome is always portrayed in both phases. That's why when the pioneers say the daily represents paganism, pagan Rome, and the abomination of desolation represents papal Rome, you're just seeing another time when Daniel's telling us about the two phases of Rome. And brothers and sisters, in verse 14 of Daniel 11, it says Rome establishes the vision. What vision? The vision at the end of the world. So it's very important to be clear about who Rome is. And here we are at the end of the world, and one of the main symbols of pagan Rome in the book of Daniel, we've changed. We've changed. Destroyed our ability to really understand Rome at the end of the world. Pagan Rome, brothers and sisters, in Bible prophecy, pagan Rome gives three things to the papacy. It gives three things to the papacy, and it removes three things for the papacy. That's the basic connection between pagan and papal Rome. Revelation 13:2. Pagan Rome gave its military power to the papacy from 496 till when? 508. It gave its seat of authority to the papacy when? 330, when Constantine moved the capital of the empire to Constantinople. I want to note something for you here, though. In reality, pagan Rome gave its seat, the city of Rome, to the papacy in the year 330. But then, in 538, it placed the papacy on the throne of the earth. There's two ways you can see pagan Rome placing the papacy on the seat of authority. First, when it gives it the city, and this is the primary one. Don't trip over this. 330 is the primary one, but it also placed it on the throne of the earth in 538. And verse 2 of Revelation 13 says it gave its civil authority to the papacy when? 533. When Justinian identified the Pope of Rome as the head of the churches and the corrector of heretics. It also removed three horns during the same history. And who are the three horns? Ostrogoth, Heruli, and the Vandals. Removes three things, gives three things. Rome establishes the vision. Brothers and sisters, the pagan Rome is a type of the United States. If you're going to understand the United States, you need to understand pagan Rome. We're not going to go into this in depth, but I want you to see something here. So at least it can click on you that, yes, there is a reason to understand the dynamics between pagan and papal Rome here at the end of the world. The United States, USA, this is pagan Rome's work, which parallels the USA. When did the United States begin to give its military strength over to the papacy according to Bible prophecy? In the Ronald Reagan years, brothers and sisters, we brought our military strength into alignment with the papacy in order to fulfill verse 40 of Daniel 11, the collapse of the Soviet Union. Let's put Reagan years, all right? This process began. Now, but notice something. With the military power here, it was a process of seven kings. First was Clovis, king of France. Last was King Arthur, king of England. So the giving of the power to the papacy according to the type of how pagan Rome did it, it's a process. It's a process. It began with Ronald Reagan. There's a lot of ways you can show Ronald Reagan as a parallel to Clovis. But the United States, brothers and sisters, is also the one that's going to place the papacy on the throne of the earth. It's going to give it its seat of power. Its seat of power. And the United States is going to accomplish giving the seat of power to the papacy in a twofold manner. In a twofold manner. What's the two horns of the United States? Republicanism and Protestantism. At the end of the world, it changed, but let's just stick with Republicanism and Protestantism. In order for the papacy to take the moral authority, the seat of authority over the United States is going to have to fall in two ways, religiously and civilly, statewise, church and state. It's about church and state. When did the United States fall religiously? To the papacy. Come on, we're Seventh-day Adventists. No. We're Seventh-day Adventists here now. Think back. When did Protestant America fall to the papacy? Not in terms of the Sunday law, but morally. 1842. Sister White says that fall is what? It's progressive. But brothers and sisters, from 1842 onward, when the organized churches in Protestant America closed their door to the Millerite movement, whether we think about it or not, they've been praying to Satan, and Satan has been answering their prayers. That's what inspiration tells us. Since 1842. Correct? Isn't that how you read it? Yeah, they submitted to Rome, whether they understand it or not. Of course, now they're right in bed with Rome. But that's when the religious aspect gave Rome the seat of authority over it. When did the political aspect of the United States surrender to the papacy? 1984, during the Ronald Reagan years, Ronald Reagan appointed an ambassador to the Antichrist of Bible prophecy, and all the Protestant churches in America said, Amen. And that secret alliance has only escalated to where it's an open alliance today. And this took place in the history of verse 40 of Daniel 11, the collapse of the Ottoman, or collapse of the Soviet Union, which parallels the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And when is it that the United States is going to give civil authority to the papacy? Revelation 13, verse 14. It's going to surrender at the Sunday law, but in Revelation 13, verse 14, it says, the United States, verse 14, and the United States deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. There's only one definition of image of the beast and inspiration. It's the combination of church and state with the church in ascendancy of that relationship. It's not the combination of church and state, simply. It's the combination of church and state with the church in control of the relationship. And in verse 14, the United States is going to command the whole world to accept a church-state relationship. It's going to command the whole world to accept the marriage of Ahab and Jezebel. And this parallels Revelation 17. In verse 17 of Revelation 17, speaking of the 10 kings, the United Nations, of which the strongest member of the United Nations is the United States, it says, "For God hath put in the hearts of this group of people to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast." The beast is the papacy. Now let me say something here, brothers and sisters. The USA gives its authority at this point in time to the papacy when the 10 kings agree to give their kingdom to the beast. They've been in the process of giving the seat to the papacy since 1842. They took the second step with their civil structure in the Ronald Reagan years. They began the process of giving their power in the Ronald Reagan years. There's a brother here that pretty much understands this message. You know what he says about this? And he's not dogmatic. It's just an observation. I probably shouldn't put it on the tape, but I'll put it on the tape just to stimulate your curiosity to study this further. This process of 496 to 508, the seven European kings all came into church-state alliance with the papacy, changed the legal profession of the religion from paganism to Catholicism. Ronald Reagan was a two-term president. George Bush was a one-term president. Bill Clinton was a two-term president. And George Bush II is a two-term president, which equals seven. We could very well be right at the end of this process with George Bush. Of course, you'd expect that if we were at the end of the process of power being fully given to the papacy before it was placed on the throne of the earth and the Sunday law arrived, you'd expect to see the judgments of God in the land. You'd expect to see the economy teetering. You'd expect to see wars. You'd expect to see pestilences. Where are we at in time, brothers and sisters? Where are we at in time? But the United States in verse 40 of Daniel 11 came in alignment with the papacy and removed the first geographical obstacle, the Soviet Union. There's two more left because the United States is going to remove three. The next one is the United States itself. And the one after that is the national sovereignty of the countries in the world. The point is this, and believe me, on all these subjects here, I've just given you a surface overview of how this history here of pagan Rome is identifying what's going on in the world today. I've given you that history in a very shallow way to let you see that if we do not understand the role of pagan Rome in placing the papacy on the throne of the earth, then we're not going to understand the role of the United States in placing the papacy on the throne of the earth. And therefore, when in the book of Daniel portrays Rome in two phases, and the book of Daniel says Rome establishes the vision, what does it mean here at the end of the world when we suddenly become confused about what Rome is? It means that Satan's made his march upon us. And it's time that we need to come back into a correct understanding of the foundations of Adventism and build upon those in order to understand what's about to take place on planet Earth. Now, let me show you something outside this presentation. There's a brother in here that I appreciate. I have no position one way or another. I'm not threatened by anything that he said, but I want to share something that he and I have been having a personal dialogue about, just to show you something, if you will. If you're in Revelation 17, Verse 16 says, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." And one of the first evenings that he and I discussed, he says, "It's the beast that burns her with fire." And I said, "Show it to me." And he read that verse, and it doesn't say the beast burn her with fire. It says the 10 kings burn her with fire. And I told him that evening, I says, it's not threatening to me even if the beast does burn her with fire. And I never explained it to him, but I'm going to explain it to you, Lord willing. But he went home and he got in the Greek. And the Greek says that the 10 horns and the beast burn her with fire. And the point that he's making, although he and I have not, I can't express his total understanding because we haven't talked in that much depth, but the point is that he understands that I'm saying the beast in Revelation 17 is the papacy, and the woman in Revelation 17 is the papacy. So if the beast is burning the woman with fire, how can the papacy kill itself? And I don't believe... So I'm going to try to explain that to you, all right? And give my case for it for him and for you to try to push you on to also bring an understanding of Revelation 17 into agreement with Daniel 11. So very quickly. This usually takes a couple hours. We're going to do this in about, Lord willing, in about 10 minutes. Verse 1 of Revelation 17. First point to take note of. "And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show you the judgment of the great whore which setteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away into the spirit, into the wilderness." First thing to note, one of the angels from Revelation 16 brings this vision. And in Revelation 16, in verse 19, it says that modern Babylon is divided into three parts. Verses 12 and 13 tell us that the three parts of modern Babylon are the beast, dragon, and false prophet. So I submit to you the fact that one of the angels from Revelation 16 that brought the vision of Revelation 17 to John is teaching us that we need to understand Revelation 17 in agreement, in connection, in conjunction with Revelation 16. And therefore, the understanding of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet in Revelation 16 could very well connect with Revelation 17, and hopefully I'll show you how it does. In verse 3, John's carried away to the wilderness. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 6 and verse 14, it identifies that the wilderness is the 1260 years of papal rule. John is carried away to the dark ages because he's going to see the woman, the papacy, drunk with the blood of persecution. John received the revelation in the year 100. The papal church was not in existence. If he was going to see the papal church during and after the persecution time, he had to be carried forward into the future. The future he was carried away into was the wilderness, the 1206 years of papal rule. In verses 4 and 5 and 6, he sees the woman riding upon the beast. And she's drunk. And she's called, among other things, the mother of harlots. So I submit to you, she's drunk with the blood of persecution. He's not simply carried into the 1260 years of papal rule. He's carried to the very end of the 1260 years of papal rule, after the woman has drunk the blood of the saints. You get drunk after you drink. He's far enough into the 1260 years where the Protestant churches are already falling away from their Protestantism because she's become the mother of harlots. She already has daughters. So he's at the very end of the 1260 years. And then the angel that came from Revelation 16 says he's going to show him the mystery of the woman and the beast. And for me, the mystery of the woman and the beast is the healing of the deadly wound. In the Bible, the papacy is portrayed as a woman, an impure church, Jezebel. But she's also portrayed as a beast power. But the papacy is a kingdom of Bible prophecy. It functions as a kingdom of Bible prophecy by employing other civil powers to do its dirty work. When the papacy received its deadly wound in 1798, it ceased to be a beast of Bible prophecy. It ceased to be a geopolitical power ruling the world. But when it received its deadly wound in 1798, it continued to be a church. It continued to be a woman of Bible prophecy. And the mystery of Revelation 17, the mystery of the beast and the woman, is how the papacy once again returns to be a geopolitical power ruling the world. But, the papacy employs a secondary civil power when it's ruling the world. There's two entities, and I would submit to you that those two entities, the entity, the ten kings, are the civil power. But in verse 8, it gives the descriptions of the beast that was and is not. And if you go through this, I can show you that we're not going to take time for this. The beast that was the papacy during the Dark Ages. It is not. Received its deadly wound, but it shall ascend. It'll return. Bottomless pit is something that has no foundation in the Word of God. I know that some people say that there's a beast that comes out of the bottomless pit in Revelation 11, and we know that that's atheistic France during the French Revolution time period. And they conclude, therefore, here in verse 8, this power out of the bottomless pit must be atheism. That's false logic. There's no justification for saying the bottomless pit represents atheism. If you do that, if you insist that the bottomless pit has to be atheism, you destroy the foundations of Adventism. Because Islam, in Revelation chapter 8, came out of the bottomless pit. And if bottomless pit represents atheism, suddenly Revelation 8 and Islam and the fifth and sixth trumpet have to be atheism. The bottomless pit, according to inspiration, represents something that comes from Satan, whether it's atheism, Islam, or Catholicism. Here in verse 8, this beast that was and is not, it goes into perdition. The papacy is the son of perdition. And this beast is, they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life. If you read Revelation 13, the power that the whole world wonders after, is whose name are not written in the book of life, is the papacy. All the characteristics of this beast that was and is not is the papacy. Now, generally, there's another way to show who the beast is that people haven't taken note of, and I want to show it to you here. Look at verse 11. Better start with verse 10, just so you can put verse 11 in context. Chapter 17. We're in chapter 17. Everyone with me? Chapter 17, verse 10. Here's the riddle of chapter 17. And there are seven kings. According to Daniel chapter 2, what's a king? Thou, O king, are the head of gold. A king is a kingdom in Bible prophecy. And there are seven kings, seven kingdoms. Five are fallen, one is, and another is not yet come. When he cometh, he must continue a short space. But here's what I want you to look at. And the beast that was and is not, that's the beast of verse 8. Whoever the beast of verse 8 is, it's the beast that was and is not. And here in verse 11 it says, the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven. Brothers and sisters, the beast that was and is not is eighth and is of the seven. Okay? So is the beast something different than the papacy, because the woman is the papacy. Sister White says so in the Great Controversy. But is the beast something other than the papacy? Very quickly, in Daniel chapter 7, there are 10 horns, right? And 3 horns get removed. For what? For the little horn to come up. Who's the little horn? The papacy. Where did it come up? In Italy, right? So in Daniel chapter 7, the eighth horn is the papacy, and it's of the seven. Rome always comes up eighth, and it's of the seven. In Daniel chapter 7, the eighth horn is the papacy. It came up in Italy. It's of the seven. Upon the testimony of two or three things established. In Daniel chapter 8, you have, it begins in the time of the Medes and Persians. How many horns did the Medes and Persians have? Two horns, right? And they were followed by who? Alexander the Great. He had one horn, right? But then his horn was broken. And out of it came how many horns? Four. And then in verse 9, what do you have? You have the eighth horn come up. And who is it? It's Rome. It's of the seven. Revelation 13. You have a beast that has seven heads. Right? Seven heads. And one of the heads is wounded, but the deadly wound is healed. Who's the eighth head that's healed? It's the papacy, and it's of the seven. If you remember, we read a quote last night from the book Education. You have it in your notes, where she says, the crown removed from Israel went to Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. The kingdoms of history are Assyria, Egypt, Israel, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, and then papal Rome. And papal Rome is of pagan Rome. Rome always comes up eighth in Bible prophecy, and it's of the seven. So if you go back to Revelation 17, verse 11, and it says, and the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven, you tell me who the beast is. It's Rome. It's Rome, and it's in agreement with the characteristics of verse 8. But it's identifying that the papacy has returned to control the world, to the geopolitical power. That's what the story of Revelation 17 is about. How the papacy committed fornication with the 10 kings. In the story of Elijah, who's the papacy? Jezebel. Was Jezebel supposed to be married to Ahab? Unlawful relationship. Who was Ahab? Is one of the kings. King, civil power. It's talking about the combination of church and state. How many kingdoms, how many nations, how many tribes was Ahab the ruler over? 10. So what we're seeing in Revelation 17, 5 have fallen. One is yet to come, and the eighth is of the seven. The first kingdom, there are seven kings. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, papal Rome. Why do I say this, brothers and sisters? Why do I say this? Because in verse 3, John is carried away to 1798. He's standing right here in 1798 when he sees this vision. And in 1798, he sees seven kingdoms, five of them have fallen. The kingdoms of Bible prophecy are established in the book of Daniel, and the books of Daniel and Revelation are the same book, according to Sister White. And she says, in the book of Revelation, the same line of prophecy is taken up as in the book of Daniel. And in the book of Daniel, the kingdoms of Bible prophecy are Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, papal Rome. John is carried away to 1798. He's carried away to the wilderness after the woman's drunk with the blood of persecution. He sees seven kings, five that have fallen. Kings are kingdoms. One is, what's the kingdom that is active in 1798? United States, USA. One is yet to come. It's the 10 kings. Now, brothers and sisters, in Revelation 13, what does the United States do to the world? It deceives the world. It's the deceiver. It's the deceiving power. In the story of Elijah, remember, there's a power that deceives, the priest of Baal and Salome. And the United States is the deceiver. And there's also a civil power, right? Ahab. So I'm submitting to you that the 10 kings represent the United Nations, the world civil power, the one world government that the world's just about ready to be forced to accept, and they're going to be forced to accept it by the power of the United States. And the eighth is the papacy. The return of the papacy, the deadly wound, is healed. So what am I saying? That the sequence in Revelation 17 is correct. Five kingdoms, sixth, seventh, eighth. But in reality, brothers and sisters, in reality, if you can follow this, I know I'm moving quickly. The sixth, seventh, and eighth kingdom, the United States, the United Nations, and the papacy, the sequence is correct. It's describing how this takes place. But they're not really the sixth, seventh, and eighth kingdom, because the angel from Revelation 16 is the one that brought this vision to John. And he's telling John, this is how the threefold union of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet come together at the end of the world. This is the dynamic. So in reality, this is telling the story of how the threefold union comes together at the end of the world. In reality, this is a description of the sixth kingdom. the sixth kingdom. And therefore, when you look at it that way, it, the sequence is correct, but this is the final kingdom, the sixth kingdom of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet. And you know what you get when you have that? That in reality, the United States is the sixth kingdom, so is this, and so is this. And you come up with 666, the final kingdom of Bible prophecy. Now, why is it that the beast would turn and burn the woman with fire? The beast is describing the geopolitical structure that is controlled by the papacy. And the geopolitical structure that's controlled by the papacy is this false prophet. It's the United States, the United Nations, that is under the moral direction of the Pope of Rome. And when the Euphrates dries up and the realities of the end of the world come to light, they turn on the papacy and burn her with fire. Up to that point, it's been a threefold union, which was the beast of the papacy. And in this beast of combination of church and state with a deceiving power, who's the one that's riding it? Who's the head? The papacy. If you're riding a horse, who's controlling your ride? The horse or you? Of course, it depends on the horse and the rider, probably. But typically, the rider is the one controlling the horse. You know, I don't ride horses. I rode a horse two times in my life. The one time I got thrown off, and the other time he walked out about a mile very slowly, and then he turned and he ran full speed back, and it was enough for me. I don't get on horses. But typically, the person riding the horse is the one that's in control. And that's what's being described in Revelation 17. The woman is the one that is the authority over this threefold union. The threefold union is the beast. And at the end, the ten kings are going to realize, the ten kings, the United States, they've been deceived, that everything's been a lie, and they're going to turn on her and burn her with fire. Brothers and sisters, there's much more to be said about that. When the ten kings here in verse 17 agree to give their kingdom unto the beast, that's this kingdom. You can show, if you go carefully through the chapter, the ten kings are the seventh kingdom. No matter who you define the ten kings as, if you're not going to say they're the United Nations, fine. Still, the structure of the chapter is very clear to show, number one, that the ten kings receive one kingdom. They do not receive ten kingdoms. Read it. It says, these kings, verse 12, and the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet. These ten kings receive one kingdom. This isn't the former pagan empire of pagan Rome. And the seventh kingdom, by the way, is future to John's day, and pagan Rome was back before John's day. The seventh kingdom has not yet come. Pagan Rome had come long before that. But this seventh kingdom, it says the ten kings agree to give their kingdom unto the beast. Why do they agree to give their kingdom unto the beast, and what is their kingdom? They are represented by Ahab. They are the civil power. They're going to give the civil authority of the one world government over to the Pope. Why? Why are they going to do that? Brothers and sisters, was there ever a time in history when civil authority was given to the papacy? Yes. In 533. Justinian gave the civil authority over to the papacy. Why? Because his kingdom was falling apart. The trumpets were blowing, the Roman Empire was coming down, and there was a religious crisis going on in the kingdom. The religious crisis was, is the church at Rome the preeminent Christian church, or is the church in Constantinople the preeminent church? And it was politically best for Justinian to say, the Pope of Rome is the head of the churches and the corrector of heretics. And he gave his civil authority away in a legal document when he said that. Now, look at the history. Religious crisis going on. The trumpets of Revelation are destroying the Roman Empire. There's a crisis going on. Brothers and sisters, the role of the descendants of Ishmael, according to Genesis 16, verses 13, is that the descendants of Ishmael would be wild men. Their hand would be against every man, and every man's hand would be against them. The Bible teaches that Islam is the issue that brings the one world government together. Islam is already doing its work of bringing the world to its knees, whether you believe it or not. It's happening. It's going to only get worse. And in the midst of that crisis time, the world's going to say, we need to solve this problem of radical Islam, and suddenly we're paralleling the history of Justinian. The world can't trust George Bush to solve the problem of Islam. No way. Not the cowboy from Texas. And the world can't trust the United Nations because they don't get anything done except rob money. But there is a moral authority in the world that we can trust to be the great moral detector of what is acceptable Islam and what's unacceptable radical Islam. And the 10 kings are going to agree to give their kingdom to the papacy in the midst of a religious crisis, radical Islam, and in the midst of the time period when the world is coming down around them and the history of 533 is being repeated before our very eyes, and we're sleeping on. But the only way you can recognize this, brothers and sisters, is by recognizing the relationship of pagan Rome to papal Rome as established in the books of Daniel and Revelation. And if you want to destroy that understanding, then you take part of the story of pagan Rome and you change it. And the understanding of pagan Rome that has been changed, brothers and sisters, is the daily. Because in the story of the daily of Daniel 11 is the history of when the three horns are removed. It's the history of when the profession of paganism was removed from those kings. It's the history of the authority, power, and seat being given to the papacy. And here we are at the end of the world and we don't even understand that what the pioneers said was right, let alone understand that it was prefiguring what's going on in the world today. But we're here. We're here. How many of you have been, there's only a couple, how many of you have listened to the Prophecy School material? Raise your hands. Okay, I want to ask you a question for the group. These ideas that I threw out here tonight, in the Prophecy School material, do we defend them in a much deeper and broader fashion? Oh yes. I want you to understand that this isn't just all there is to defend these positions, brothers and sisters. Prophecy School is 40 hours of building to this conclusion. What I'm saying is, if you're doubting what you're hearing, you haven't heard all the arguments behind it. There are more arguments.
I believe that Uriah Smith was used by the Lord.
Me too.
At his time. I believe that I think you're someone that the Lord is going to use, is using now, and will use as an expander of what he did, and there's new life that, I mean, his book was wonderful, but it has error in it, and it would be hard for someone like my son, who said he will read it if I send it. It'll be hard for him to sort it out, but if you can take what you've presented and make it very clear, very simple, very structured, to where it's easy to follow.
Did you all understand her comment? Because I have a response to that. I disagree with you on a couple points. Sister White says the book Daniel and Revelation is God's helping hand. Mm-hmm. There are places in it where I believe that Uriah Smith is incorrect. But if someone's truly going to take up the work of being a student of prophecy, then what they have to do, and I didn't read a lot of the quotes, I read a couple here this weekend, they have to go back and come to grips with what the pioneers put together. And the best overview of that I've ever seen is the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith. Yes, there are a couple problems with it, but if someone will take up the work of a student of prophecy and work through that book, work through Haskell's book to where they've got the foundations of Daniel and Revelation, then you can intelligently explain to them the areas where Uriah Smith went astray. But here's my point. One of the places where Uriah Smith went astray, I believe, as the pioneers all did, stood things is who the Ten Kings is of Revelation 17. So in Uriah Smith and the pioneer position of Daniel 2, you have a perfect talking point to say, okay, let's go back and see why the pioneers were understanding this incorrectly. But let's see how these ten toes connect with the Ten Kings of Revelation 17, and the same with the King of the North. And that's the two main places.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying is you're a person who can lay all that out. So when someone is reading Daniel and the Revelation, they can
let me show you something.
What you're doing.
Let me show you all something. Please. Daniel 12, verse 3. We read a quote from the Spirit of Prophecy that says, by the increase of knowledge, God's people will be prepared to stand in the latter days. By the increase of knowledge. And she has just quoted Daniel 12, verse 4 when she says that. And in Daniel 12, verse 3, it says, and they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Brothers and sisters, there's an increase of knowledge at the end of the world. And the people that are going to understand it are who? The wise. The wise. Look in the margin. Look in the margin. What is wise? Teachers. Teachers. If you're going to be the wise, you have to teach the final warning message. You can't depend on anybody else to teach it. That's what the word wise is teachers. You got to come to grips with it for yourself. I can't teach your son. If a human being's going to teach your son, it's going to be you. Let me tell you, that's a common statement from people that go through this. But the reality of it is we took a great deal of time and trouble under conviction. We put together a prophecy school. We did it professional, where you can take it VHS or DVD, go your own speed, hit the pause button.
Oh, so you're saying that's what the prophecy school?
The prophecy school is the very foundation, right down to the role of radical Islam at the end of the 40 hours. Everything. All the charts, all the graphs. That's why I've been pushing that DVD prophecy school, but I don't want to push it too hard or you're going to leave here thinking all he's trying to do is make money and sell stuff, and I'm not. But that's, if you want to come to grips with this message and test it, get the DVD or the VHS. And there's people here that have it, and there's people here that said they know people that can duplicate it. Go ahead and don't buy it. Get it duplicated. I don't care. Okay. That's if you want to come to grips with what we're teaching, use prophetic minutes.
I would like you to maybe explain which Daniel and Revelation book by Uriah Smith. I have heard, like you said, good and bad about him. So I went to Colleen Duran, who was in the Heritage Room. She said there's a whole wall shelf of Uriah Smith books. He would write it, change it, do this, and the next one would be good. The next one wasn't good. And so maybe if you give us the date of your publication.
Well, when I refer to him, I use the Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith off the Pioneer CD-ROM, which is the original one. But the sister you're talking about, what she said was not too bad, but some people actually say that if you don't have the original Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith, then the changes that people were tampering with it in a sinister way. But what they don't realize is that book was designed under the provisions that once it was written, if new information came to light that further clarified the prophecy, then in the next publication they were going to change it. So it was a book that was designed right from the outside, set to go through changes. So the fact that it's went through changes is not necessarily that sinister, although there may have been a little bit of that. But what I'm saying is prophecy is confirmed by history. And Uriah Smith is giving you the history and the logic that the pioneers use to come to understand the books of Daniel and Revelation. And it's that history that prefigures the end of the world. And it's pretty much sound any of those Daniel and Revelation books that you pick up. I like the original one. But use the one you got. Get started. After you've went through it, you won't be going to it. You'll be going in the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy exclusively once you get started.
We're told the events of the French Revolution would be repeated. How does that fit into this?
The pioneers understood that the seven trumpets were the historical forces that brought down the Roman Empire. The first four trumpets brought down the Western Roman Empire. The second, the next two trumpets, the fifth and sixth, brought down the Eastern Roman Empire. But in the sixth trumpet, one of the most important events in Adventism takes place with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. So when you get to the end of the sixth trumpet, you come to Revelation 10, and you have a description of the Millerite movement, which is directly connected with the sixth trumpet. As soon as you're done with Revelation 10, it goes into Revelation 11, and Revelation 11 tells how Papal Rome was brought down in the French Revolution. So it's a continuation of thought. The trumpets, the first four trumpets bring down Western Rome. The next two trumpets bring down Eastern Rome. French Revolution brings down Papal Rome. All of these histories are illustrating some aspect of the end of the world. And the atheism of France, brothers and sisters, the atheism of France, you can trace down through history. It's the dragon power. And it still exists today in the United Nations, the dragon power. Usually in Adventism, we're familiar with Sister White saying that the dragon power is spiritualism. But in Testimonies to Ministers, she has a quote where she says, "Kings, governors, and rulers are represented as the dragon that goes to make war against his saints." It's a multitude of political figures that are the dragon power at the end of the world. And that multitude of political figures is the one world government that we know as the United Nations, and the philosophy that is the foundation of the United Nations is atheism. These are the influences, Islam, atheism, that bring the threefold union of the papacy of modern Rome down at the very end. So there is a repeat, but I mean, to go through and nail all the dynamics would take a great deal of time, but it's all established in that history that we kind of reject anymore. We're in the seventh trumpet. Sixth trumpet came to an end on October 22nd, 1844. We're in the sounding of the seventh trumpet now. And we're reaching the time when it's about to be finished, when God's going to develop the 144,000 and go bring others into the fold. Okay, I got the... Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, I thank you for the time that you've allowed us to spend here this week in this part of your vineyard. And I know that I've been sharing a lot of information, and some of it new, some of it old. And I know that as an instrument, I'm certainly not the best, so I ask that you would accompany this material and the hearts and minds of those that have heard it this week with your Holy Spirit and your angels, and take the brethren here, the sisters and brothers, back to this information in their minds. Let them be convicted of their responsibility to test these things, compare them with your word, compare them with what's taking place in the world, and see if they're so, and that if they come to the same conviction that the Sunday law is about to take place, the probation's about to close, I ask that you'd give them wisdom and discernment on how to order their life accordingly. We thank you for such easy times to come together and study. We know there's so many people that are suffering from the judgments that are in the land today around the world, and we've just had some very easy times here. We thank you for that. We know these times are about to be taken away from us. We ask that if we don't meet here again on planet Earth, that somehow, some way, you would allow us all to meet again on the Sea of Glass. In Jesus' name, amen.